Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP monthly training series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Children in Court and New Wyoming Supreme Court Decisions presentation. Today, Shauna Herron, Senior Assistant Attorney General at the Wyoming Attorney General's Office, and Elizabeth Lance of Lance and Hall, a Wyoming Guardian ad litem, will provide a presentation about the importance of a child's attendance at Wyoming juvenile court hearings. This presentation will provide an overview of a recent Wyoming Supreme Court decision in the interest of DT and NT minor children. In this case, the Wyoming Supreme Court found a presumption that children be present at juvenile court, and the statute on permanency hearings requires the children be present at the permanency hearing unless the court makes a determination that they should not be present prior to the hearing. The presenters will provide information related to recent amendments to the Wyoming Rules of Procedure for Juvenile Courts, which requires a child shall be present at the permanency hearing in abuse and neglect actions unless the court orders prior to the permanency hearing that the child need not be present. If the guardian ad litem or other party believes the child should not be present at the permanency hearing, a motion outlining the reasons for the request for excusal from the hearing shall be filed no less than 10 days prior to the permanency hearing. These rule changes became effective on June 1, 2018. The presenters will provide practice tips about how to best comply with the rules. Shauna and Elizabeth, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. As mentioned, my name is Shauna Herron. I'm with the Wyoming Attorney General's Office. I represent the Department of Family Services in day-to-day advice and other litigation issues. This afternoon, we're going to give you an overview of the statutes that are currently in place in Wyoming for presence of children during juvenile court proceedings. I'm going to give you a quick run through of the previous juvenile court rule for the presence of children in those hearings. And then Beth is going to talk about the recent In Re DT decision from the Wyoming Supreme Court and some policies of the Guardian Ad Litem program. And then she'll give you an overview of the recently revised court rule. And then we'll talk about some research that we found on whether children should be present in the courtroom and maybe some best practices and special situations that we think maybe merit some consideration for kids in the courtroom. So first, let's talk about the statute. So as Beth will explain here in a few minutes, the main statute that the In Re DT decision talks about comes from Title 14. It is 14-3-431. And the statute, if you look at subsection K, talks about what the court has to do during a permanency hearing. One of those things, in addition to looking at a determination of reasonable efforts at the permanency plan, the court is required by the statute in subparagraphs 3 and 4 to ask the child about the child's desired permanency outcome if it's determined that the child should be present at the hearing. And four requires the court to ask the child's guardian ad litem or another legal representative about the child's desired permanency outcome if it's determined to be inappropriate for the child to be present at the hearing. The statute doesn't really give any guidance for the court or the litigants involved in the case about what should be considered when determining if the child should be present or not at the hearing. We really don't have much guidance at all in the statute other than the court should determine whether the child should be present or not. It does seem that the statute requires some sort of determination about the child's presence at the hearing, but in addition to not giving any guidance about when it's appropriate or not, the statute also doesn't give any guidance about when that decision should be made. There's a couple of other statutes, and this statute in 431, paragraph K, is really the focus of the In Re DT case. But there are a couple of other statutes that I think that parties should be aware of in the juvenile court setting, because there are other statutes in Title 14 that can come into play when you're looking at whether a child should be present at the hearing. So the second statute is 14-3-424. And if you look at subparagraph B, it allows the court to excuse a child temporarily from a hearing if the court finds that it's necessary for the best interests of the child. So that is one avenue for especially the guardians ad litem out there and the social workers. If you feel like, you know, the child's presence at the hearing is really important, but maybe there are certain portions of the hearing that could become harmful or detrimental to the child, or maybe there's a no contact order in place between the child and a parent or other adult, the court can allow the exclusion of the child from a portion of the hearing. So that is certainly one avenue for everyone to be aware of, that even if the court requires the presence of the child at the hearing, you do have some leeway to ask the court to let the child be excused from portions of the hearing that may be sort of detrimental to the child's mental health or safety. Another statute that it's really important to be aware of is Statute 14-3-413. This statute talks about orders to appear for an initial hearing. So if you look at subparagraph A, it requires that after a petition is filed, the court must issue an order to appear. And there's some provisions in subparagraph A about specifics that are required to be in the order to appear, and it has to do with the initial hearing. So when you're looking at an initial hearing, the last provision required to be in the order, it has to be in Romanet 4. The order to appear has to be directed to a child if they are 14 years of age or older. So for those of you in this area of law, and certainly for the prosecutors out there, this is something that you may want to look at to create a form that you always submit to the court when you are initiating a case, is that if you have a child who's 14 years of age or older, the court has to direct that the child be there in person for that initial hearing. And for the social workers out there, this is something that you're going to want to schedule transportation in consultation with your guardian ad litem. And if you feel that There are scheduling issues. Certainly talk to your prosecutor and the guardian ad litem to look at potentially rescheduling if it's not going to be practical for the child to attend for the scheduled hearing. But it does require that the court direct the child to attend if they're 14 years of age or older. Certainly another statute, 14-3-415, looking at subparagraph C, it does allow the court to order a child to issue a bench warrant for the child's attendance if the court finds that the child is willfully avoiding service of process or refuses service, or if the court finds that the welfare of the child requires that he be brought immediately into the custody of the court. That statute allows the court to issue a bench warrant for the child to appear. I don't think that statute is used directed at the child particularly often, but it's certainly available if the parties deem that it is necessary for the child to be brought before the court physically. So those last three statutes certainly were not a focus of the court in the DT decision, but it's certainly a good idea for practitioners in this area to be aware of those statutory provisions. But certainly the most important is at the permanency hearing, where the court is required to either ask the child directly or ask the guardian ad litem about the child's desired permanency outcome. So turning to the juvenile court rules, prior to June 1st, we had a rule for procedure of juvenile courts, Rule 2, Subsection A, talked about the presence of the child at hearings. So the old rule required that or said that a child who's not of suitable age to understand or participate in the proceedings did not have to be present at the proceedings if you're talking about abuse and neglect cases, unless there was an order to the contrary for the court. So the rule really allowed the parties to look at whether the child was of suitable age to understand and sort of left it up to the discretion of the guardian ad litem and others in the action to determine whether the child was of suitable age to understand and be present. It really gave a lot of leeway for the parties to decide whether the child should be present or not. Besides looking at the suitable age to understand or participate, the rule, in addition to the statutes, really doesn't give the parties or the court really any guidance about how to determine suitable age to understand and participate. So it seemed to really leave the parties and the court sort of to make a discretionary decision about whether the child was of suitable age to participate. So next, Beth is going to talk about the DT decision.
Thanks, Shauna. So the decision that I'm referring to, just so you can, I believe there's a link off the Blog Talk website up right now, but it is 391P3rd 1136. It's a 2017 Wyoming Supreme Court case. And I was actually the guardian ad litem on this case at the trial court level. I did not handle the appeal, but I was the guardian ad litem making the decision in this case that the children did not need to appear at the permanency hearing. And it gave a lot of guidance then through this opinion from the court as to what they believe the law is as to presence of children at permanency hearings. And then since this case came out, we have had specific change then to the rule that Shauna just discussed under the juvenile court rules. So we've now have a lot more guidance on on all of this, which is good, I think. But just to go over this opinion, essentially the facts of this case were that when this case was brought about initially, this was a situation where the children were living in a hotel room that was very filthy, full of boxes, really to the extent that it was quite unsafe living conditions for the children. There's also drug paraphernalia found in the apartment around the children. And so the children were taken into protective custody based off of those facts, and an initial shelter care hearing was held. I was the guardian ad litem appointed at that hearing and throughout the case. At that time, we discussed and it was agreed upon that a consent decree be entered on behalf of the mother in this case, seeing that we felt there was a good likely chance for her to be able to turn things around, have the children return to her. So she cleaned up the hotel room. We put in place certain things through the case plan, such as urinalysis testing, drug treatment, things of that nature. And she was complying initially and working a consent decree. However, things ended up going downhill from there. Eventually, the consent decree was revoked. Her admission was then entered into the record, and she was adjudicated neglectful at that point. So then the case plan continued, however, towards family reunification. There was, in fact, if I recall, I think there was a second time the children were actually returned to her care. So reunification efforts were, very vast. Certainly the department was, I think, doing a very good job in this case of getting her all the services she needed to work that reunification plan. And however, it ended up failing again. And at that point, the department looked at relative placements for the children that we could, in the back of our minds, think about where the children could reside maybe on a more permanent basis. Mother agreed at this point. And so mother ended up agreeing that the children should be placed with her mother, which at that time was in South Dakota. And so the children were placed in South Dakota with the grandmother, and that is where they continued to reside at the time of the permanency hearing. At that point, the recommendation was that permanency change to adoption by the grandparents, and so that the children would remain in that placement and be adopted. There were two children. The oldest child at the time of the permanency hearing was 8 years old. So this was difficult, I think, as far as looking at necessity to attend and whether that child was suitable age to be relaying these opinions in open court. I think 8 years old can become difficult. That's a borderline age, maybe a little bit. I think obviously it's very clear we usually think of 14 and up is a really good age that we expect the level of maturity to fully participate in all hearings and be able to be questioned, potentially testify, all of those things. But at 8, it was a little more of a question. Additionally, obviously there was a transportation issue, who and how were they going to go to South Dakota to retrieve the children, bring them here, where would they stay here, how long then would they be away from school, probably multiple days. So taking all of those things into consideration, then I did recommend that the children not be present at the permanency hearing. And so at that point, during the permanency hearing, then the judge did address the fact that the children were not present. So that is on the record. The court made a finding at the permanency hearing that it was inappropriate for the children to be present at the hearing. And both myself and the state questioned the DFS caseworker on the stand as to the children's preference for adoption. I also made a closing argument wherein I stated the children's preference as to adoption. And mother did not request the children's presence, did not object to their lack of presence at the hearing. And the first time any mention of it was made was on appeal from mother's part. So considering all of this, the Supreme Court looked at two main issues considering the presence of the children at this hearing. The first question the Supreme Court analyzed was whether the juvenile court committed plain error when it did not determine whether the children should be present at the hearing prior to the hearing. And there is, a citation then here by the Supreme Court as to the statute that Shauna mentioned earlier, which is 14.3.431K, Romanets 3 and 4. And that was the statute as stated by Shauna, that at the permanency hearing, juvenile court shall ask the child about desired permanency, ask the GAL about desired permanency. So as I stated, I was asked about the children's permanency, and I did make statements towards that. But because the children were not present, they were then not asked themselves as to that. So then it was a question then as to whether that was plain error. And the court was limited to a plain error analysis here because the mother had not objected, because the mother had not made motion for the children to be present. So because the first time this issue was brought was on appeal, it was a plain error standard. And so we may have had a different analysis by the court if they had been able to review this at a different standard. But due to it being a plain error standard, the court did not find plain error. However, the court did make statements in this opinion that that inquiry as to whether children should be present at the permanency hearing should be done prior to the hearing. And so the Supreme Court, when looking at that statute, determined that that is how they read that requirement. And so while the statute does not read expressly that a decision must be made prior to that hearing as to whether the children are present, the Supreme Court is advising here that that's how that occur. And so that's an important point that they're making, I think, in this opinion. The second question that the court was asked to look at on this appeal was then, were the mother's due process rights violated when the juvenile court did not require the presence of the children at the hearing? Again, mother did not call the children as witnesses. She did not object to the children not being present. She did not question the state's witness about the children's preferences. So again, this is a plain error analysis. This was brought for the first time on appeal. And so the court under this analysis also found no plain error. However, again, the conclusion of the court here was that a determination whether the children should be present at a permanency plan hearing should be made prior to the hearing. And so while the court affirmed the judge's determinations on this, on both of these issues, the court did take its opportunity in this opinion to make clear that they are looking for the district courts to be making these determinations prior to that permanency hearing. And it is not upon any requirement for the parent. It is simply that that is the rule and that's what needs to be happening. Also, I wanted to mention our guardian ad litem policy on children in attendance of these court hearings. Our policy has been, even prior to these changes, has always been, as long as I've been a guardian ad litem, which is many years now, that certainly, of course, in CHINs and delinquency proceedings, children must attend. And, of course, we also encourage those children to be at all their multidisciplinary team meetings as well. But when we look at abuse neglect hearings, it has also been the policy of the Guardian Ad Litem program that all children, regardless of age or the type of juvenile case, should attend all significant court hearings in which they are the subject. So that was our policy. However, it was always noted to us that the child is not required to attend abuse neglect hearings pursuant to the Wyoming Rules of Procedure for Juvenile Courts Rule 2A, which is the rule that Shauna went over before. So the old version of this rule indicated that unless the court ordered that attendance, that it wasn't required. So obviously, best practice was children should be in attendance at court hearings. However, it wasn't required, and so how I was working as a guardian ad litem on this issue in the past was that I would work to have children there unless I had a compelling reason that it was inappropriate or detrimental to the child for some reason. And in this case, with DT, there were several reasons, which was, a matter of inconvenience, obviously, with them being a state away, a matter of them missing significant amounts of school, and a matter of their age and whether they were suitable to be there. So those were all taken into consideration on my part as a guardian ad litem. However, now I don't make that decision anymore, which is okay. I kind of am relieved that this decision now is on the court. And so the way in which this is going to work going forward is that children need to be present at all hearings, especially permanency hearings, and that if there is some reason that they shouldn't be, then motions need to be filed, and then the court can make that determination pre-hearing as to whether that child is required to be present. So if we look then at the new juvenile court rule, it is now numbered Rule 2B, and it is listed as presence of the child. And now the way this reads is that a child shall be present at the permanency hearing in abuse and neglect actions unless the court orders prior to the permanency hearing that the child need not be present. So now this determination has to be made pre-hearing. As was indicated in DT, this is just a follow-up of consistency to that opinion. And so it makes it clear that the court has to make this determination pre-hearing. But it does leave an opportunity as a guardian ad litem to file a motion with the court. And so then it reads, if the guardian ad litem or other party believes the child should not be present at the permanency hearing, a motion outlining the reasons for the request for excusal from the hearing shall be filed no less than 10 days prior to the permanency hearing. So a motion may be filed, and all of the reasons that a guardian ad litem or other party may have to request excusal of the child from that hearing should be set forth and in that motion very specifically. And then the court can make that determination as to whether the child must be in attendance or not. There's another statement here also under the rule which says a child is encouraged to attend all other hearings in abuse and neglect actions. So again, while this speaks specifically towards a permanency hearing, it is important to note that the court is really encouraging what has been the guardian ad litem policy, which is that children attend their court hearings. There are some court hearings, I think we all know, where we're going to be there about 2 seconds and almost nothing's going to be said. And I hesitate to pull children out of school for a hearing of that nature. So I think we're allowed to still use that discretion. But I think we also know many of these hearings are very significant, and a lot of things are going to be discussed that do impact the children. And so we do need to be bringing children to as many hearings as possible. But this rule does go on to say a child need not be present at other hearings in abuse and neglect actions unless the court so orders. So it is not requiring by law that the children are present at every hearing. It is only specific to permanency hearings. However, certainly, and Shawn is going to talk a little bit more about what she found on the research and study side for psychology of children and best interests of children as to why we want them in court and why we want to work to get them to as many hearings as possible.
Thanks, Beth. So in our research in preparing for this presentation, I tried to find some research articles or law journals out there about, you know, scientific research into whether it's helpful or harmful for children to be present in abuse neglect proceedings. And I didn't find a whole lot. One article that I did find, which was published by the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, it was published in August of 2012. It's a technical assistance bulletin. It's called Seen, Heard, and Engaged, Children in Dependency Court Hearings. And it really gives a nice overview of some of the limited research that has been done up to 2012, and give some good practice pointers to resolve certainly some of our concerns about children being in the courtroom in some of these situations. But the research that they found is that children really should be, you know, effectively involved in permanency planning. And I think, you know, most of our training really lends to we want kids more engaged in their own permanency planning. But it also found that children should be more engaged in their court hearings. So, for example, one study found that children who attended court hearings were more likely to report that they trusted the judge, and they trusted the judge to do what was best for them, more so than children who did not attend those same hearings. The kids that attended the hearings also felt that the judge knew enough to make decisions and the right decisions for their lives, and then found that the kids who didn't attend those hearings did not feel convinced that the judge had enough information to make a decision about their own permanency. There was a survey of kids who have gone through the juvenile court system, and the majority of the youth who completed the survey, it was called a Home at Last survey, the kids indicated that when they did attend court, they found it helpful. They found that being allowed to attend those court hearings made them feel like they were more informed about their own life and that the experience was worthwhile. So what we're finding is that kids are reporting themselves, you know, certainly more engagement and that they feel like they were more informed about their own permanency. The article also includes, there's a lot of different agencies and boards and councils out there regarding children and juvenile courts. And there's a number of different agencies that have passed recommendations about whether children should attend hearings. So in 2012, the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges passed a new recommendation, and their presumed practice was that children should attend court hearings. And they did recommend that if a child is not in court, then the stakeholders in the case should explain to the judge that there was a safety or well-being reason for the children to be absent from the hearing. And they recommended that the judge make a determination that the child's absence was appropriate for either a safety
or well-being reason. And I think it's important when you're looking at the National Council recommendations is that there was no assumption that a child might be too young to attend the hearing. There's other associations, for example, the National Association of Council for Children. In 1999, they passed a similar standard in abuse and neglect cases, and their standard indicates that children in most circumstances should be in attendance during significant court hearings. And the article goes on, and if anyone wants a copy of the article, I'm happy to send it to you or ask Edie to post it to the CJP's website. But the article does contain other standards from other councils and organizations, and all of these organizations really do have a stated preference for children to attend court hearings. The article goes on to note that a lot of people involved in the child welfare system have significant concerns for a child's well-being to attend certain hearings. Some of those concerns, which I think we would all agree that are somewhat valid, is that participating in those court hearings could upset the child, that there are transportation potentially issues like Beth mentioned in the DT case, that those children were placed in South Dakota. So certainly transportation was an issue and can be an issue in many cases. There's concerns that these hearings could disrupt the child's schedule. And as we all know, the consistency and predictability are really important issues for the children that we serve. Sometimes there's concerns in hearings for the child to see the parent, especially if there is a no-contact order entered requiring that the parent and child not have contact. And the article does a nice job of looking at ways to assuage some of these concerns and looking at ways to maybe make things easier for the children. So, for example, if you're looking at scheduling problems for the child and that it's going to disrupt the child's life or school or educational schedule, one of the recommendations is to try and schedule hearings during school in-service days where the child is not actually in school. Or if the child gets out of school at 3 p.m., try to schedule those hearings after 3 so that the child's not being pulled out of school. And while that may be a lofty goal, I think we all realize that the court's docket is much more complicated than that. And certainly if that is available, I think that's a great way to work around the child's schedule. But I think on a practical level, that may be difficult. And some of the concerns about that the participating in the hearings that will upset the child, you know, I think we all sometimes forget that these children have lived through, you know, the issues that are bringing this family to the attention of our system. And I think we maybe don't give the children enough credit for what they already know about their parents' circumstances. But I think it's important to realize that it's certainly a good thing, unless it's harmful, maybe give the child another opportunity to have a visit with the parent, an opportunity for the court and the parties involved to see how the parent and the child interact. And if you have a judge who certainly can't go and to watch a visitation between the parent and the child, this would certainly give an opportunity, if it's appropriate, for the child and the parent to have a quick visit during a hearing that the court can observe.
the court can look at if there are any negative or positive reactions from the child, can see potential bond or lack thereof between the parent and child, and certainly gives the court some face time with the child. And certainly I think we would all agree that the children are probably the most important players in our system. And I think it's helpful for judges to lay eyes on the kids that are going to be impacted by their decisions and not just have face time with the other parties, but really put, you know, an actual child's face to the name so that they know who they're making decisions about. I think certainly there's a lot of other practical implications in this area, but certainly I think there are ways that we can work around some of those concerns, as mentioned in this article. But I think the research certainly shows that it empowers children, and it's beneficial for children, for the most part, to attend and being able to have face time with the judge themselves. And potentially have a quick visit with their parent as well. I think Beth and I have discussed some other practical considerations with, for example, in the DT case with the children being in South Dakota, we threw around the idea maybe if transportation is an issue, maybe look at video conferencing for the children to attend so they wouldn't have to travel that far.
And I think that those could be potentially good alternatives in certain cases. I would caution, though, with the way things are now and the clear opinion of the court and the clear rule that we now have for permanency hearings, for something like that, again, I would say file a motion, get permission for that. Don't just assume that you can show up to the permanency hearing and say, yeah, court, or hey, judge, we're going to just call these kids on the phone. I think that you could be setting yourself up for failure there. So I would say I think that we could see that video conferencing or phone calls may be a solution, but again, I would use caution with that, and I would file a motion requesting permission for that before proceeding with the child's presence being done in that manner rather than actually being there in person.
I think as another practical issue, I think all of the parties in these cases should, you know, pay special attention to scheduling when you're coming up on a permanency hearing. For my social workers out there, I will, you know, really recommend that you talk to the guardian ad litem and the prosecutor about whether they will file a motion to excuse a child from a permanency hearing, or if you need to be looking at making arrangements for transportation for the child. I think 10 days in the rule prior to the hearing for filing of a motion, that's a really short turnaround time. So for the attorneys out there, if you're going to file a motion like that, I think it's always best practice to deliver a courtesy copy directly to the court's chambers so that the court has really quick notice that the motion has been filed, potentially allowing other parties to respond if they so choose. But certainly for the guardians ad litem out there, please, you know, try to work with your social workers out there to look at transportation issues and whether the department should be making arrangements for that. Any other practice tips?
Yeah, I agree. I think calendaring is going to be important now. Be paying attention to all hearings. Again, kids should really be at all significant hearings in their own case. But obviously at this point, be very careful with those permanency hearings and be sure that you are calendaring yourself time to file those motions to excuse the children if you have grounds in which to do so. And I agree with Shauna. I think attorneys and you know, social workers are just going to have to be communicating about these hearings and communicating about how to be sure that the kids are present. Unfortunately, for my program as a guardian ad litem, our policy dictates that I am not to be transporting children. So I can't really be a helper on the ground in that way. But certainly I know, reach out to your CASA workers. They can be really helpful. I would say most of the time foster parents are who bring kids to my court hearings. So I would say foster parents are a great resource. I know social workers are often, like I am, have several hearings set at the same time like I do, so transportation for them could be difficult. So be thinking about who else can help to get children to these hearings.
And I think for the attorneys out there, if you're looking at filing a motion for any of the hearings, but especially as required for the permanency hearing, certainly I think looking at the 14-3-424 statute that allows the court to temporarily excuse a child from a hearing, certainly look at whether that is an appropriate statute to include in your motion. If you feel that maybe there's a portion of the hearing that the child may not be you know, best to attend, there's ways that maybe the parties can work out for the child to attend a portion of the hearing, and that's certainly authority that you'll want to bring to the court's attention. If you're only asking for temporary exclusion, and you know, if there are other ways that you can look at minimizing any negative impacts upon the child, if there are screens or if the attorneys and the child can meet with the judge in chambers without the parents' presence, if that is a potential negative impact. I think there are other solutions. I think you can be creative on this issue to help minimize any potential negative impacts for the children that you're working with. That's certainly an option for you to bring to the court's attention, that availability as well. So I think we have a quick question on the chat line. There's an area of the state where the judge will make a determination at the beginning of a case that the child need not be present due to mental capacity, either at shelter care or at the initial hearing. And the court's order continues throughout the life of the case until further order of the court. And the judge will make reference to the previous order at subsequent hearings. And the question is that sufficient to comply with the requirement if the children miss the permanency hearing? Beth, you want to take that?
I would say as to the permanency hearing, I believe no, that I would not take that as sufficient. Because really we're looking at it at a very clear rule. It's a shall. Children shall be present at permanency hearings. Absent a determination, and I don't see that as a specific determination as to why the children are not to be present at a permanency hearing, wherein they should be asked what their preference is and they should be present. So I would be concerned if that were my court and my case, that was the only order I had going into a permanency hearing to excuse my client. I would be concerned.
And I completely agree with Beth, and I think that the rule really contemplates that the attorney has to articulate some pretty specific reasons to exclude the child from presence at the permanency hearing. So I think that you, if you're going to do that and ask to exclude the child, you need to make a pretty specific record as to presence at the permanency hearing specifically. So I would agree orders, prior orders from the court may not be sufficient under the new rule. So I think we'll open it up to any other questions, concerns, or comments from anyone else.
And just a reminder, if folks want to call in with their question, the phone number is 917-889-8064. Seeing folks call in or add any questions to the chat. So I think we can go ahead and wrap up. And I did want to thank everyone for joining us today and just let you know that this is our last blog talk for the season. And we thank you so much for being with us this year. We will start our new series in October, so keep an eye out for those dates. And Shauna and Beth, anything to add before we wrap up?
No, I don't think I have anything further, but thanks everyone for listening. Yes, thank you everyone. We appreciate your attendance.